Yes, okay. So there were many developments concerning the convergence of Fourier series. And in fact, I don't know if you know a little bit about the history of mathematics. Mathematics used to be just one thing. And then it split into pure mathematics and applied mathematics. And Hilbert sort of walked off in one direction with the pure mathematicians, leaving the applied mathematicians behind. And basically, he said, you know, you applied mathematicians are doing ugly things. You're working on messy, dirty problems. Let's work on beautiful, abstract problems that, you know, which are elegant and you know, have all the properties of beautiful mathematics. And you applied mathematicians can just do useful things, you know. So I have to say, I'm in the branch of people who are more interested in doing applied mathematics, and specifically applying mathematics to physics. And I'm going to present Fourier series from that point of view, okay? Hilbert did not want to work on Fourier series because he regarded it as too ugly and too messy, because the question of convergence of Fourier series is such a complicated and broad question, and it's still not completely understood. There's still open questions involving convergence. But anyway, this is how a physicist or a mathematical physicist would come across Fourier series. And what I want to do is present it to you as a way of solving a very physical problem. Okay? So I want to solve the heat equation, Ut equals Uxx. This is the heat equation or the diffusion equation. And we need, in order to solve this equation, it's interesting, and I won't actually go into that here. This is a second order equation. You would think that it requires two initial conditions in order to specify the solution, because it's second order, right? That's what you would think, but it isn't true. It requires only one initial condition. And there are two ways that you might present an initial condition. You might say the initial condition is given for all x. You might say u of x and 0 is some specified function f of x for all x. And so here we have diffusion on an infinitely long one-dimensional wire. Okay, again, by the way, for the heat equation, u of x and t is the temperature in a wire at the point x and at time t. So it's very straightforward. This is a very down-to-earth problem. And you might give the initial condition for all x. And this is called the Cauchy problem. And we can talk about this, but that is not the way we're going to come about Fourier series in the most efficient fashion. So what I'm going to do is, in fact, take a more general... I'm not going to do this. I'm actually going to specify u of x and 0 equals f of x, not for all x, but let's say for x between 0 and pi. Okay, so we're going to consider just an we're going to consider a finite piece of wire instead of an infinite piece of wire. So here's the wire. It extends from 0 to pi, and I'm choosing pi just for convenience. Okay, obviously we can scale the problem and go from 0 to L. Okay, or from A to B or whatever. Okay, but this is the most convenient interval to use for what we're going to do, and so this is the wire is just has a finite length. And if the wire has a finite length, in addition to giving an initial condition over here, we have to say what happens at the end of the wire. Okay? I mean, you have to specify something, because now we would have an ambiguity. So we need to give boundary conditions. And there are many ways of giving boundary conditions at the end of the wire, because you could say, at the end of the wire, say it's x equals 0, the wire is attached to a heat bath. So the heat bath has a temperature associated with it, and it tells you, you know, as a function of time, what the temperature is. So you might say something like U of 0 and T is G of T. Okay, that's an example of a boundary condition. Or you might specify the derivative of U at x equals 0, and that tells you how much heat is flowing into the wire. So you could either attach the wire to a heat bath, okay, or you could simply specify that you're pumping heat into the wire at a certain rate, or taking it out of the wire at a certain rate. Okay, and the problem that we could focus on, just to make things simple, is I'm going to use a heat bath, and I'm going to say that U of pi and t is some other specified function, h of t, okay? And for now, just for today, I'm going to take g of t to be 0 and h of t to be 0. Okay, so this is the simplest possible case, okay? Now, this is a very simple case compared with having g of t and h of t being non-zero, and I'm going to be showing you that we can use Fourier series to solve this general problem for arbitrary f and g and h. Okay? And we're going to go back to that, and you're going to see why Fourier series are so incredibly powerful. Okay? Because we're going to be able to solve this general problem, and that is remarkable. Yeah.
Does this correspond to having some sort of sink at the two ends?
Yeah, a heat bath. Okay, so in other words, you know, I'm specifying right at this point, for all time, I'm telling you what the temperature is going to be. It's going to be G of T. That means, of course, that G is varying in general as a function of time. H is varying, so heat might be going in, and then it might be flowing out again. And so this is a very complicated physical situation. So we're specifying what's happening at the end of the wires, what the heat distribution in the wire is at time zero, and the heat is just going to be flowing in and out and back and forth in the wire and so on, and we're going to try to find the temperature everywhere in between. This is a very, very sophisticated problem if we leave H and G, these two functions, if we leave them arbitrary. For now, let's just take them to be zero. Okay. So the question is, how are we going to solve this problem? What I showed you last time, I mean, this is a hard problem, right? So what I showed you last time was that when you have a hard problem, you might want to use Taylor series. But for PDEs, they don't work. And the reason is because Taylor series converge inside of circles, and diffusion is a process that's only flowing forward in time. Diffusion doesn't, you can't undiffuse. Okay? Diffusion doesn't go backward in time. If you try to go backward in time, things become less and less spread out. You know, you can imagine smoke undiffusing in a room, okay, back into a cigarette or something like that. So they become more and more concentrated, and eventually they become singular, and the solution ceases to exist. Okay? And this is associated, as I'm sure you know, with entropy, okay? And the fact that the, you know, you've heard the phrase the arrow of time and things like that, entropy is in the universe is increasing. It's not decreasing. It doesn't go backward in time. Okay, so we're not going to use a Taylor series, because the Taylor series in powers of t has singularities for negative values of t, which means that the Taylor series ceases to work for positive values of t. And that's terrible. Okay? So we want something that continues to work for positive values of t. So what we're going to do is, instead of writing u of x and t is some Taylor-like series, sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n of x, t to the n, this is not good. What we're going to do is we're going to replace t to the n by b sub n of t, some arbitrary function here, b. Okay? And this is called, you notice x is here and b is here, okay? And this is called a separated variable series. Okay, so the separated variable series. Okay. And so how do we proceed from here? Well, the only thing we can think of doing is substituting this series into the differential equation. But you see, with Taylor series, we could argue that Taylor series are unique. So we could collect powers of t, okay, and argue that the coefficient of t to the n is a true, it must hold for each value of n. But we can't do that here. So this is a real puzzle. So I'm going to do something very strange. I'm going to argue, because I can't think of anything else to do, okay, I'm going to argue that rather than collecting powers of t, I'm simply going to argue that each term in this equation satisfies the differential equation. Now, that is an extremely strong requirement, because that's not what happens with Taylor series. The way Taylor series work is that it only satisfies the differential equation if you sum over all n. You understand what I mean? It's only the whole Taylor series that satisfies the differential equation. Each term in the Taylor series doesn't have a chance of satisfying the differential equation. But in the case of a separated variable series, I don't know anything else to do. So I'm going to make the simplest possible assumption. I'm going to say each term in this series is required to satisfy the differential equation. Okay? So that gives me that. So if I plug it into the equation, it means that for any n, I'm going to require that the time derivative of the nth term, which is a sub n of x b prime of t, must be equal to the second derivative of this with respect to x, okay? A sub n prime prime of x b sub n of t. Okay? This is an incredibly strong requirement, and you might think that this is so strong that there's no chance of solving the equation at all. In fact, that's the most reasonable guess. If I saw this, if I had never seen this before, I would be laughing at this point and saying, this is ridiculous. This is much too strong. How can you possibly solve such a complicated differential equation with such a simple requirement? But in fact, you're going to see this works. Okay. And now, the next part of the argument is something that I'm sure you've seen before. What you do is you say, I'm going to separate the dependence on x and the dependence on t. And the way we do that is divide both sides of this equation by ab. Okay, we just divide it. Okay, so we get b sub n prime of t over b sub n of t is equal to a prime prime of x over a sub n of x. Okay, of course here I'm ignoring the fact that b and a might possibly be zero. Okay, so I'm dividing by zero. I'm just casually proceeding and dividing by zero. I'm not even worrying about it. Of course, at the end of the calculation, we might be lucky enough to find that a and b are not zero. But we don't know what to do at this point, except to do something like this. Okay, and then I'm going to argue as follows. I'm going to say, look, this does not depend on x, and this does not depend on t. So the equation cannot depend. So both sides of this equation can do not vary either with respect to x or with respect to t. So this can only be a constant. Okay, it could only be a constant. And if I look at the time dependence, if I solve, okay, this is some constant. By the way, this has a name. It's called a separation constant. Okay, it has some silly name. Okay, I want to argue that this constant really ought to be negative. Okay, why do I want to argue that it should be negative? Because when I solve the time-dependent equation, okay, so if I try to now solve b n prime of t, is equal to C times B sub N of t, the solution to this equation is very, very easy. It's just B sub N of t is equal to e to the C t, okay? And I don't want this to grow with time. Now you notice if C were a positive number, this would be growing with time. So I would like it to be, we certainly want C to be negative. Okay? We hope that C will turn out to be negative. Okay? So in fact, I'm going to write it this way. I'm going to put a minus sign in front of the separation constant, and a minus sign will appear here. Okay? So now we have a solution e to the minus ct, and now what I'm saying is we want c to be positive. Okay, just so I have the minus sign there explicitly. Okay. Oh, because you see, we want to solve this heat equation for all t, and So when I plug in a separated variable series, okay, where there's a b of t in here, if this is growing with time, that looks completely unphysical to me. It's just the terms are going to be blowing up, or some terms are going to be blowing up. That sure doesn't look good. Okay, but we're going to find out that the equation is going to assure us that this constant is going to turn out to be negative. Okay, now. Okay, so yeah.
The C is in principle dependent on N.
You're going to see that the C and the N are going to be related. I haven't yet connected them. Okay, so N could be anything here, by the way. N does not have to be an integer, even. We might be in this sum, this is just some sort of formal sum, we may even be integrating over N. Okay? But now, what do I do? I've said something about the time dependence. What about the space dependence? Now I'm going to do something really crazy. Okay? The first simplifying assumption I made is that each term in the separated variable series, a sub n of x times b sub n of t, has to satisfy this differential equation. We now have to impose initial conditions. This is some arbitrary initial condition here, with an arbitrary function f, and some arbitrary boundary conditions, okay, but which for now I'm taking to be zero. Okay? So for this homogeneous problem where g and h are zero, I'm going to make an even crazier assumption. I am going to require that each term in this separated variable series satisfies the boundary conditions as well. This seems much too strong. Okay? But I'm going to make the assumption, mostly because I can't proceed until I make such an assumption. So I'm going to assume that a sub n of t times b sub n, a sub n of x times b sub n of t satisfies the boundary conditions term by term. And this gets a couple of exclamation points because it sounds like we're making too strong an assumption here. But let's do it anyway. So let's go now, having made that assumption, let's look at the differential equation for A. Okay? So the differential equation for A satisfies A sub n prime prime of x plus A sub n times C of x is equal to 0. And we know how to solve that equation if C is a positive number. Okay, so assuming that C is a positive number, we know the solution to this equation. Can you tell me what is the general solution to that equation? It's going to be a sine or a cosine, right? So A sub n of x is equal to, say, sine of the square root of C times x, or cosine of the square root of C times x. And it's going to be some arbitrary linear combination of those two, say alpha and beta, something like that. Okay? Now, we are going to try to satisfy the boundary conditions term by term. So the first boundary condition is that a sub n of x equals 0 at x equals 0. Okay. Now, sine already vanishes if you set x equal to 0. So that implies that beta, this implies that beta has to be equal to 0. Can't be any cosines present. So we've simplified it. We've incorporated one boundary condition. And we've done that by requiring that beta is equal to 0. Now, we have to require that this vanish at pi as well. Okay, so if we require that a sub n of x equals 0 at x equals pi, of course, one way of accomplishing that is just to say that alpha equals 0. Now we've lost everything. We can't solve the problem. Okay, so the only way to do that is to require that sine of the square root of c times pi is equal to 0. And that says, this tells us, if we don't want to have, we certainly don't want alpha to be 0, otherwise we lose everything. So this tells us that the square root of c must be equal to n, must be equal to an integer n, where n equals 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Okay, because we know that sine of n pi is equal to 0. Okay, so that says that c is equal to n squared. Okay, and that is the connection between the C and the N dependence. Okay, so now what have I concluded? I've concluded that A sub N of X is some constant times sine of NX. Well, it isn't the same N, but in fact, I'm now relating the two. Okay, I'm now saying that I'm going to choose. We have a whole bunch of possible a sub n's, but we found that only a discrete set can satisfy the boundary conditions. So I'm now connecting this n here. I could call it m if you like, okay? And I'm connecting c with m. That's the only c that's going to work, okay? Is when the separation constant turns out to be n squared. Okay, that's the only way that I can incorporate this. Of course, you could say this is silly, right? Because you've made such a narrow assumption here. Okay, we have so far solved each term in our separated variable series, solves the differential equation, and incorporates the boundary conditions. And that's such a powerful assumption that maybe we can't solve the problem anymore. Maybe. Okay, but if we make this assumption, what have we got now? What we now know, we put everything together, what we now know is that our solution, u of x and t, is a sum. Notice that n equals 0 is not here. N starts at 1, because n equals 0, if you plug in n equals 0, sine of 0 is 0, so there's no term. So this is a sum from n equals 1 to infinity. And these are the only solutions that we can find that satisfy these requirements, these simplifying requirements. So we conclude that u of x and t is equal to, if you plug in a sub n of x and you plug in b sub n of t, a sub n is sine of nx, b sub n of t is e to the minus n squared t, and then there's some coefficient, okay, alpha. And alpha, in principle, depends on n. Alpha is a bunch of numbers. So we could call this A sub capital A sub n, something like that. Okay? So I'm going to replace alpha by capital A. And this is where we are. So again, what have we done? We have solved the differential equation. So the PDE has been solved. Check. The boundary conditions have been incorporated. There's only one thing left. And that's probably where this thing falls apart. Okay? Showing that our assumptions are too strong. We may have thrown out the possibility of solving the equation. What do we have left? We have to solve the initial condition. How can we impose the initial condition? Okay, and the initial condition is, so let's put that over here. The initial condition is this. At t equals 0, at time 0, we would like u of x and t, u of x and 0, to be equal to f of x for all x. And the question is, can we do that? Okay. So if we set t equals 0, we are trying to solve the equation u of x and 0, which is some given function f of x, is equal to the sum from n equals 1 to infinity a sub n. Now, if you set t equals 0, of course, the e to this exponential is now 0. And all we have is a sub n sine of nx. A sub n sine of nx. And so that's the problem. And we have arrived at the problem that mathematicians have worked on for years and years and years. This is a very, very, very subtle problem. The question is, if you are given the function f of x, can you find a set of numbers, a sub n, and these are called these are called Fourier coefficients. Can you find a set of numbers, a sub n, such that if you add up this series, it's equal to f of x? That's the problem. Okay? So this is the Fourier series. And we have arrived at it through a very physical problem. Okay? So this is the mathematical problem. Okay? It's a very, very hard problem. And how do we proceed? What do we do? Okay. So now I will tell you what. How many of you have seen Fourier series in classes before? Most of you. Okay, almost everybody. So you know what you were told. What you were told is that these functions, sine of nx, form an orthogonal set of functions. Okay, this is an orthogonal class of functions. And what you were told is this. If you, by the way, this is called a Fourier sine series. And when you studied Fourier series, instead of a sine of nx, you may have seen e to the I nx. Okay? And that's typically what you write down if you're on an interval from minus pi to pi. But we're considering the simplest possible case because I want to just study real functions. Sine is a real function of x. I don't want to bring in unimportant complexity. No pun unintended. Okay, so you learned that the sines form an orthogonal set. So what you learned is that the integral from 0 to pi of dx sine of nx times sine of mx, you learned that this is equal to, so this thing is equal to 0 if n is not equal to m. Okay, and that's true. Okay, and you learned that it's equal to, if n equals m, what is it equal to? You did learn this, right? What's it equal to? Pi over 2. And you can evaluate that just using trig identities. It's easy, right? So this is what you were told. You were told all you need to do is to take this equation here and multiply both sides by sine of mx. Okay, just multiply by sine of mx and integrate from 0 to pi. Okay, and if you do that, what will you discover? The right-hand side will vanish unless n in this series is equal to m. Therefore, on the right-hand side, you will get pi over 2 times a sub m times so having evaluated the integral, you get pi over 2 times a sub m. And on the left-hand side, you will get the integral from 0 to pi dx f of x times sine of mx Okay, and then you divide both sides, you multiply both sides by 2 over pi, 2 over pi, okay, and you obtain this formula here, which is great. There's only one problem here. Well, there's many problems here. What's the problem? What's the problem with this argument? This argument is a really, really fishy argument. What's wrong with it? You betcha. That's the problem. In general, this series, you're going to see, this series here is an extremely slowly converging series. That's the reason why we're discussing it in this course in the first place. And it is typically not uniformly and absolutely convergent. If it is uniformly and absolutely convergent, typically you can perform the integration operation that's indicated here term by term. But in general, if this is a slowly converging series, very slowly converging, okay, just a conditionally converging series, you can't do that. So this argument is really, really fishy. But if we can't do that argument, what do we do? And this is the part that's never taught. So far, everything I've said, I think, is conventional. But now we're going to get to the interesting part of Fourier series. How do we analyze Fourier series? Okay, that's the question. So how do we attack this equation over here? This is some sort of sloppy proposed solution, but how do we solve the problem in general? Okay, so let's go over here. Okay, so a really clean and nice and elegant way of trying to understand Fourier series goes like this. Step one, we are going to define the Fourier coefficient A sub n as follows. A sub n is defined as 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to pi dx sine of nx times f of x. That's a definition, okay? I didn't derive this. This is my starting point for understanding Fourier series. So I'm going to define a sequence of numbers, a sub n, simply as this integral. And that is not a problem, okay? Because we are only integrating over a finite range from 0 to pi, so that if the function f of x is any kind of reasonable function, which is what we are interested in, simple, reasonable function, then there's no question with this integral existing, and we haven't integrated a series term by term. Okay, so this is just a pure definition. And this is where we start. Okay, so the next step, we now have to show several things. Yeah.
So, you're defining an. Can we identify this an to those an yet? Or should we use a different symbol until we can?
Well, So getting this result, to get this result, we did something sleazy. So what I'm saying to you is everything we've done so far is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Forget this argument, I'm saying. So this is the unsolved problem. Okay, we don't know whether or not the coefficients a sub n that are constructed according to that formula will satisfy this equation. So I'm leaving the question marks here. Okay, so I'm simply saying, as our starting point in understanding Fourier series, that is where we start from that equation. Okay, and now we have to show several things. The first thing we have to show is, how does a sub n behave as n goes to infinity. Why do we need to study this? Yeah, why do we care about how a sub n?
You want the s of n to form like a convergence sequence.
Exactly. Not a conversion sequence, but we want that series, we want the series that we're going to construct to converge.
Yeah, but I mean, doesn't that imply that you have to have a convergent sequence for a sense?
No, it doesn't have to be a convergent sequence. Rather, we want the series to converge. Okay? Well, it's going to be a convergent sequence because there's no hope of this series converging unless a sub n goes to zero. Okay, so we want to know how a sub n behaves as n goes to infinity. In particular, as you say, we would like to show so we would like a sub n to go to zero as n goes to infinity. Otherwise, there's no hope of that series converging. Okay? But just because a sub n goes to zero as n goes to infinity, that is not strong enough to prove that that series, that the Fourier series, will converge. Okay, so this is a necessary condition. We need to show, so first we would like to find how a sub n behaves as n goes to infinity, and we would certainly like a sub n to go to zero as n goes to infinity. This, it's not obvious, but this has been shown that this is not good enough for the Fourier series to converge. In fact, we want a sub n to go to zero fast enough. Okay, we want it to go to zero fast enough so that the series a sub n sine of nx converges. Okay? So we want the Fourier series to converge. But that's not good enough yet. Why not? Because just because the Fourier series converges, what am I going to say? That's right. We don't know that it converges to the right answer. Okay, so it's perfectly possible for a Fourier series to converge, but to converge to the wrong answer. So again, here's the point. You give me a function f of x. Given f of x, I construct a sub n. Now that I have a sub n, suppose I've shown that a sub n goes to zero as n goes to infinity, and in fact, suppose I've shown that a sub n goes to zero so fast that this series converges. But it still might be that even though this converges, it might be that a sub n sine of nx. I mean, the question is, when this converges, does it converge to the function f of x that it's supposed to represent? It might converge to a different function. Now, you might think that's silly, but in fact, you have seen in freshman calculus, maybe, you've seen examples, or if you've taken an elementary mathematical analysis course, you see that this is a serious problem. Okay? Does anybody know an example where you face this problem in the case of Taylor series? In the case of real variables? So take the function, just to show you that this is a potential problem, take the function f of x equals e to the minus 1 over x squared. Okay, it's a perfectly reasonable function. And by the way, this is for x not equal to 0. And for x equal to 0, we simply say this function is 0. Okay, so this defines a function, perfectly reasonable function. And this function is infinitely differentiable. Okay, so if you draw a picture of the function looks like this. It smoothly comes down to 0 and back up again. And as x goes to infinity, this function approaches 1, and it approaches 1. So this is a perfectly nice function. Okay, and if you calculate the nth derivative of f of x at x equals 0, you get, say it again?
Zero.
It's 0. That's right. So this is an infinitely smooth differentiable function, and the nth derivative of f of x at x equals 0 is 0. Okay? So if we construct the Taylor series for this representing this function is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, the nth derivative of f over n factorial times x to the n. That's the Taylor series about x equals 0. Okay? And if you plug in the nth derivative of f, you find that this Taylor series is 0 plus 0 plus 0, and so on. Okay? So question one, does the Taylor series exist? Yes, because all these derivatives exist. Does the Taylor series converge? Yes, because 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 is a convergent series. But when you add up the Taylor series, do you get the right answer? Right, in the sense, in the question is, does this Taylor series adequately represent the function from which it was constructed? And the answer is no. This is terrible. Okay, so this Taylor series adds up to 0, but the function that you're representing is only 0 at one point. For all other x, it's not 0. But the Taylor series is 0, so the Taylor series adds up to the wrong answer. Okay, so we've seen this before. So this could happen with Fourier series. And this would be a disaster, because it says that we did all this beautiful mathematics and it's worthless. Okay? Because we're not, you know, maybe the Fourier series converges, but it converges to the wrong answer. Okay, so you had a question? I just answered it. Ah, terrific. Okay, so you all understand the problem. Okay? So now there are a number of theorems that I'm going to throw at you, which you can read about, but this is not a course in pure mathematics. So I'm going to tell you a very important result, and it's called, the question is, how do you even begin all this discussion? We did number one, and here is number two. There's a series of questions in number two, and the key question is, does the Fourier series equal the function that it's supposed to represent? Yeah?
What are we assuming of the behavior of f that is just continuous?
We're just going to assume, well,
because if the convergence will depend.
Well, clearly, the function f, the first condition on f is, the principal condition, is that f must be a function that is nice enough so that this integral converges. We need not make the assumption that f is continuous. Okay? The integral of a function that's not continuous exists. Okay? But we certainly don't want f to blow up in such a way, to blow up so fast, that this integral doesn't exist. I mean, if f of x was something like 1 over pi over 2 minus x to the fifth power or something like that, then it's blowing up right in the middle of this interval, and then there's no hope. Okay, we're not going to do that. But we certainly can assume, so we could make a nice assumption, for example, that f is continuous, then there's no problem with the integral existing. Okay, we might even make a stronger assumption that f is differentiable. Okay, and then this is lovely. Okay, you're going to see that there's some other assumptions that we need to make that are kind of crucial.
Thinking about the convergence.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If we just assume that the integral exists, then we don't necessarily have the convergence of like pointwise convergence. We have convergence.
That's right. There are different kinds of convergence, and we're going to think about pointwise convergence. That is, does this series for each value of x converge to the function f of x? Okay. There could also be convergence in mean. There could be, you know, this L2, L3, L, you know. So there's different kinds of convergence. So these are important issues. There certainly is one very important issue that we have to discuss. And this is the essential the really deep feature of Fourier series. What's the big issue here? Does anybody know? No, we don't have to use fancy words like L2. But there's just heuristically, what is the problem that we're going to have? I mean, clearly, we need to have a sub n go to 0. But there's obviously a big question here. Suppose f of 0 is not 0. And f of pi is not 0. Look at the Fourier series. The Fourier series is a sum of sine of nx, right? Now, at x equals 0, every term in the Fourier series is 0. What if f of 0 is 3? Similarly, take x equals pi. What if f of pi is 71? Can this Fourier series converge to such a function? Or is the Fourier series only going to work if the function f of x vanishes at x equals 0 and also vanishes at x equals pi? That's an interesting question. The amazing thing. Now, you understand, why is that an important question? It's obviously an important question because... Okay, hang on. So that's an important question because this is only one. We're looking at only one of an infinite number of interesting problems. The really interesting physics is what happens if you put a heat bath with an interesting time-varying temperature. You notice that the solution to this problem is... I've erased it, but the solution to this problem, you know, you only get with an e to the minus n squared t in here. That is what we claim the solution to the problem is. The question is, do we have the right to put in anything other than g is equal to 0 and h is equal to 0? Because if that's true, I'm just wasting your time. OK, I'm clearly wasting your time. Who cares? Do we have to go through all this mathematical hocus pocus just to solve one physical problem? What about all the infinite number of problems where g is non-zero and h is non-zero? Can we solve those problems? And the answer is yes. And that's the astonishing thing about Fourier series. And that's the reason why I'm telling you about it. And that's so interesting. And so that's why Fourier series are fantastic. We can, this is hard to believe, right? What I'm telling you is that even if f of 0 is not equal to 0, and f of pi is not equal to 0, this Fourier series will converge to f. 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0, you're going to see, is not necessarily 0. OK? And that's going to expose you to where we're going from here. Yeah?
So why always, when they're introducing Fourier series, they always say if f has a DC value, there is a constant.
If f has a...
0 at 0, it's non-zero at 0.
Yeah, yeah.
There is some constant term, and then there's a sinus term, and there's a cosine term.
Yeah.
If we can do all that by just the sinus term, why they're always formally introduced three terms?
You don't. In fact, sine is good enough.
Really?
Sine is, in fact, perfectly good. People like to do that. The reason is because you've probably come across Fourier series by solving something like, say, the Schrodinger equation on a disk, or some sort of differential equation on a disk, and you've imposed, you've solved it in polar coordinates, which I'm just solving a one-dimensional problem here. You've introduced two-dimensional polar coordinates, and then you've solved the equation on, you've required 2 pi periodicity. Okay, and that's how you came across your Fourier series. We can complexify our Fourier series immediately because there's another Fourier series that we can develop. Instead of requiring that the solution vanish at the boundary, we could require that the derivative of the solution vanish at the boundary, and that would give us a Fourier cosine series on the interval from 0 to pi. And then we could take arbitrary boundary conditions, mixture of the function vanishing or its derivative vanishing, and then we would end up with combinations of sine and cosine, which is e to the in x, where n runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. But we can do that later. This is the simplest version of a Fourier series. Okay? And of course, we can extend the interval. We can make it bigger. Instead of going from 0 to pi, we can go from 0 to 2 pi. That's no problem. Okay? But there's a reason why you might want to have a cosine series, and that's not obvious to you yet. Okay? A Fourier sine series is good for solving a heat bath problem, but if you impose the heat flux, then you want to solve it using a Fourier cosine series. If you have a non-vanishing heat flux, you need to solve. It's much more convenient to use a cosine series. And if you had a combination of heat flux and heat bath, okay, then you may want to have an exponential series. That's the simplest version. But you're going to see that soon. So just be patient just for a little bit. Okay? So first of all, I'm going to throw a theorem at you. Okay? And you can look it up if you're interested. This is called the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. And this is a very fancy word. What it says is that under reasonable conditions for f of x, okay, so what are reasonable conditions? Well, it says basically if f is absolutely integrable, okay, so if the integral from 0 to pi absolute f of x dx exists, then the integral from 0 to pi f of x dx times sine of nx goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. Okay? And, you know, you can guess how you would prove the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Okay? You would say, let's divide up the interval from 0 to pi let's introduce a partition, okay, with many, many little segments. And on each partition, f of x isn't going to change very much. Why? Because f is absolutely integrable, so it has to be reasonably well behaved. Okay? And therefore, we're integrating sine of nx on that each of those little intervals. Okay? And as n goes to infinity, this is highly oscillatory. So the positive contributions cancel the negative contributions. Okay? And so on each little interval, it goes to 0. And then you sum over all the intervals, and then the whole integral goes to 0. And that's sort of the argument. I'm not going to go through that argument. And that's something you can look up in a math book. Okay? So this is a very useful theorem because it kind of answers the first question. It say, you know, we say, how does a sub n behave as n goes to infinity? Well, we would certainly like a sub n to go to 0 as n goes to infinity. And the answer is, yeah, it does. OK, so that's nice. But it turns out, this is really amazing, that I can give you examples where a sub n does go to 0. And yet, this Fourier series over here does not converge for any value of x. So that's not good enough. We need a sub n to go to 0 fast enough so that that Fourier series actually converges. Okay, these examples are very, very, very fancy examples. And they're amazing examples because I would have thought that if the coefficient a sub n goes to 0, that would be enough to assure that this series converges. Why is that? Because the sine is oscillatory. So sometimes the sine is positive and sometimes the sine is negative. So there's enough oscillation in there, you would think, so that this converges at least as a conditionally convergent series. But in fact, it's not true. It's actually not true. So we need something stronger. So let's see if I can give you some simple arguments. So So let's ask, can we at least look at this problem, let's avoid special crazy examples that pure mathematicians will think up for us, and let's investigate the behavior of this integral just using some elementary mathematics. Okay, so how do we investigate this integral for large n? Well, for large n, a sub n, for large n, a sub n goes like, okay, how are we going to study how this thing behaves? Let's just integrate by parts. Okay, so I'm going to assume that we can integrate by parts here. Okay, so it says that my f of x is going to be, we're not considering all conceivable functions, but some reasonable functions. So if I integrate by parts, I have a factor of 2 over pi. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to integrate sine, and I'm going to differentiate f. So one integration by parts gives me an evaluation from 0 to pi, cosine of nx over n, with a minus sign, right, minus, two minus signs, giving me a plus sign, integral from 0 to pi, 1 over n, dx, cosine of nx, f of x. F prime of x. Okay? And I've left off an f of x here. Okay? Now, let's evaluate the boundary term. This boundary term is minus f of pi times cosine of n pi over n. And then at the lower end point, we're at 0. So that gives me f of 0, cosine of 0 is just 1, divided by n. Okay? So that's the boundary term. And cosine of n pi is minus 1 to the n. So the boundary term is of order 1 over n. Okay. Okay. So now, how does this behave? These two terms are vanishing like 1 over n. Okay, these two terms vanish like 1 over n, but this vanishes faster than 1 over n. Why? Typically, this term has to vanish faster than 1 over n. Why is that?
Because the integral decreases.
Because why? Why is that?
Because it's
linear. Ta-da! Because of the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Riemann-Lebesgue lemma says that this integral by itself vanishes. Doesn't matter whether that's a cosine or a sine. Doesn't make any difference. So by the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, this vanishes. I could write here, we should write, if this is true, then sine or cosine or x, e to the ix, it doesn't matter. This vanishes as n goes to infinity. So by the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, this already vanishes as n goes to infinity, and it's multiplied by 1 over n. So the biggest term that's present is a term of order 1 over n. Okay? So typically, the Fourier coefficients a sub n go to 0 like 1 over n. That's how fast Fourier coefficients go to 0. And that's quite typical. Okay? Yeah?
Couldn't it be that the f prime is not a 0
multiplier? Of course. So that's why I said, let's assume that f is some sort of reasonable function. So we're going to assume that f prime exists. We'll make that assumption that f. So that means we're not looking at all possible crazy examples that pure mathematicians will make up. So we're making the assumption that this guy actually exists. And if it exists, we're going to assume that it satisfies the condition of the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. So then we end up with the result that typically Fourier coefficients go to 0 like 1 over n, unless something wonderful is true. Okay? A sub n goes to 0 like 1 over n, unless f of 0 equals 0 and f of pi is equal to 0. Okay? If f of 0 and f of pi are both 0, then this term vanishes and that term vanishes, right? And now this stuff is not here. So what do we do? This is all that's left now. So now we know the Fourier coefficients go to 0 faster than 1 over n. How fast do they go to 0? How would you find out? How about integrating by parts? Okay? So if we integrate that term by parts, we get a sub n is equal to 2 over pi times n, 2 over pi n. Now, if we integrate this by parts, we have a boundary term. When we integrate cosine, we have sine of nx, sine of nx over n times f prime of x evaluated from 0 to pi. Okay, and then minus 1 over n integral from 0 to pi dx sine of nx f double prime of x. Okay? Now, something wonderful happens. Look at the boundary term. We don't care about f prime of x. Who cares about f prime of x? This vanishes. Why? Because sine vanishes at 0, sine of nx, and sine of nx vanishes at pi. So now we've gotten it down to this. Okay? How fast does this? So now we have two factors of n in the denominator, but what am I going to do? I'm going to integrate by parts. And if I do another integration by parts, I will be repeating what I did on the first line up here, and I will conclude that a sub n goes to 0 like 1 over n cubed. Unless what? F double prime vanishes at the endpoints. Okay, unless f prime prime of 0 equals 0 and f prime prime of pi is equal to 0, in which case a sub n goes to 0 like 1 over n to the 5. That's right. Goes to 0 like 1 over n to the 5, unless f4 primes of 0 equals 0 and f4 primes of pi equals 0, in which case a sub n goes like 1 over n to the 7, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see the pattern? Of course, if all of the even derivatives of f vanish at the boundary, then the Fourier coefficients go to 0 like a shot. Okay, they go to 0 like mad. Okay, so they vanish faster than any power of 1 over n. So if you are expanding a function in a Fourier series, and this function happens to have a derivative, have any number of derivatives, and if all of the even derivatives vanish at the boundary, then you know that the Fourier series will converge very, very rapidly. Okay, extremely rapidly. Okay, now, are there any questions about this argument? Now, we've proved that the Fourier series converges. Clearly, once we know, so let me summarize. If we know that the Fourier coefficients go to 0 as faster than 1 over n, if we know that, then this Fourier series will be absolutely convergent. Okay? Do you understand why? Why is that? Can somebody just give me the argument? Suppose this a sub n goes to 0 faster than 1 over n. Like 1 over n to the 1 plus epsilon, something like that. Well, go ahead. Absolutely. So it converges uniformly and absolutely. Uniformly means for any x, okay, without any dependence on x. Okay, so how do we prove it? You've said it. All you need to do is to say, look at the absolute value of this. By the triangle inequality, we can take the absolute value of the whole thing. and bounded above by the sum of the absolute values. But the absolute value of sine is less than or equal to 1. So we can bound that above for any x by 1. And then we just have the absolute values of a sub n. But the absolute value of a sub n is going to 0 faster than 1 over n, and that series converges. So as soon as we know that the Fourier coefficients go to 0 faster than 1 over n, then we're home free. Then we know this series is absolutely and uniformly convergent. If the Fourier coefficients go to 0 like 1 over n, however, then it is not absolutely and uniformly convergent, but it is in fact true that the Fourier series is still conditionally convergent. Okay? So now I want to show you some pictures, because I want you to see what the Fourier series looks like, okay, if you try some numerical experiments. Now, we still haven't proved the key thing. We have not yet proved that just because the Fourier series converges, it converges to the right answer. But before we give a proof, you have to see what it looks like. Okay, so what does a Fourier series look like? Okay. Okay, good. Good. Okay. So here's the point, or here's the summary. We're talking about Fourier sine series, and these are typically slowly convergent series. Okay, these are slowly convergent series. This is the Fourier series that we're looking at, and we are asking, how does it behave in the region where x lies between 0 and pi? Okay. And so we have to calculate the Fourier coefficients. We know the orthogonality property. Okay? Here is the definition of the Fourier coefficient that I showed you. Okay? And here's an example. Okay? So first thing I did was I said, look, let's take a function which by construction vanishes at x equals 0 and vanishes at x equals pi. It's a nice simple function. Okay? And if you do the integral, if you evaluate the integral here to find the Fourier coefficients, that's very, very simple. All you need to do is to just integrate by parts and evaluate it. You notice that the Fourier coefficients vanish like 1 over n cubed, as I promised they would. Okay? In fact, this is the explicit formula for the Fourier coefficient. Actually, every other Fourier coefficient is 0. Okay, but the odd Fourier coefficients go like 1 over n cubed. Okay, so this is a formula for the Fourier coefficients. Okay, and now let's look at how the Fourier series behaves. Okay, now this Fourier series is a... Where did I put the... Oh, there it is. Okay, so let's look at the Fourier series. First of all, it's hard to see this because the Fourier series is so incredibly good. Okay, so here, you see this curve right here? That is the function x times pi minus x. Okay, so it's coming down like this. It vanishes at 0. It vanishes at pi. Now, here is the one-term Fourier series. So I'm truncating the Fourier series at n equals 1, just one term. Okay? And if you make a plot of it, look how accurately it approximates the function. Okay, so this here is S1, right over there. That's S1. Okay? So now if you take two terms, you can no longer this is S1. This right there is the function that you're trying to represent. It's the one that's a tiny bit higher than that one. This is S2, two terms in the Fourier series. And the only place you can really see the difference between S2 and the function you're trying to represent is right at the top here. There's a little whitish bump in here, little difference, okay? I can't plot, there's no point in showing you S3, three terms in the Fourier series, because you can't see the difference on a graph. Okay? And the convergence is fantastic. Okay? However, you can say, what happens if you take the function f of x equals 1? Okay? Because that's a nice smooth function, but f of 0 is not 0, and f of pi is not 0. F of 0 is 1, and f of pi is 1. So what happens in the case of Fourier series? Well, let's go ahead and calculate the Fourier coefficients. Okay? So the Fourier coefficients, remember, you expect that the Fourier coefficients will go to 0 like 1 over n, and they do. And the formula for the Fourier coefficients is 4 over pi times n if n is odd, and 0 if n is even. Okay, and let's ask, how well does the Fourier series converge? So it looks like this. So the function 1 starts over here at 1, and it goes straight across to 1. Okay. Now, let's take a 5-term Fourier series. So just 5 terms in the Fourier series. So what does that partial sum look like? Well, you know at x equals 0, it has to vanish. And what it does here is it comes up like this, comes up very quickly, and it overshoots 1. It goes higher than 1. All right? And then it comes down and up and down and up and down and up. And the overshoots get bigger. They get smaller for a while, and then they get bigger. The oscillations get bigger. And then they reach a bump over here, and then they come down to 0 again. Well, that's not a bad representation of 1. Of course, it's not exactly 1. It's wiggling about 1. But it's, you know, it basically comes up. It's roughly 1, and it comes back down again. That's 5 terms in the Fourier series. Now, what happens if you take 20 terms in the Fourier series? Well, it starts at 0, as before, and it comes up, and it makes a little bump over here. And then it oscillates, but the oscillations get smaller and smaller, and they come all the way across here. But you see here, you see this slightly bigger bump here. Those are the oscillations with 20 terms in the Fourier series. Then the oscillations get bigger and bigger. They finally reach the biggest bump over here, and then they rapidly go down to 0 again. Now you take 80 terms in the Fourier series, and look what happens. It comes up. It makes a bump. It overshoots the answer. It's very strange. It overshoots the answer, and it overshoots it by a certain percent. Do any of you know what the percentage of overshoot is?
10.
It's not 10.
9.
Don't say 8 for your next guess. No, it's actually a very famous number. It's 18%. Okay, it's an 18% overshoot, and that is a universal number. It's actually true for any function, 18%. It's always 18% high right there. So what happens is it starts at 0, it goes, misses 1, overshoots by 18%, and then it says, I'm going to fix this. So it comes back down again, and it oscillates with very, very tiny oscillations, follows the number 1 all the way, and then at the last moment it goes, one last blast. Okay, and then it comes back down to 0 again. And you can see what is happening. What is happening is that the Fourier series is doing something like this. You're trying to here's the interval from 0 to pi. And you're trying to represent the function 1. That's the function 1. And when you take many, many terms in the Fourier series, many, many, many terms, what happens? The partial sum can't possibly be 1. It has to be 0. That's because if you add up a finite number of zeros, you have to get 0. 0 plus 0 plus 0 n times is 0. No argument about that. Okay? It then comes up and infinitely close to the point at 0, it overshoots by 18%. So this number here is approximately 1.18. Not exactly 1.18, but it's very close to 1.18. Okay? And then it comes back down again, And if you have a lot of terms in the Fourier series, it's equal to 1 all the way across. Point-wise convergence. Okay, so you asked me about what type of convergence. So for each value of x, it is coming arbitrarily close to 1. Okay? And then infinitesimally close to pi, it overshoots by 18% again. And then it comes back down. And that's what the Fourier series looks like. Okay? So I claim that this Fourier series has converged to the function 1. Why did it converge to the function 1? Because for any value of x not equal to 0 or pi, it approaches in a pointwise fashion the function 1. Okay? And if you start in the interior of the interval and walk outward toward the edge, adding more and more terms in the Fourier series as you go, it is approaching the number 1. Of course, at the last moment, it isn't 1. It goes boop. Okay? But you don't know that because you haven't gotten there yet. So as you approach the edge, it's approaching the number 1. So it converged to the function 1, even though 1 is not 0. It's fantastic. Okay? It is because of this that we can solve this arbitrary, you can't see it anymore, but this arbitrary heat equation problem where we are not imposing homogeneous boundary conditions. And that's what I'm going to show you next time. Next time, I'm going to start off with a proof. I'm going to actually prove to you, I can do this in just a few lines, that in fact, this Fourier series really converges to the function 1. It's not just a proof by plot, but it's an absolute proof. It's a real rigorous proof. Okay? That's what I'm going to show you at the beginning of the next lecture. So have a great weekend, and I'll see you on Monday. Okay?
Did I start doing that? Did you